everyone, and welcome to Rewatchable number 201. We are going to be talking about Buffy the Vampire Slayer Season 5, Episode 11, Triangle, and Angel Season 2, Episode 11, Redefinition. As always, if you'd like to get into contact with us, you can email us at rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. Find us on Twitter at re_watchable. This post on Hypebeable.com or rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. My name is Karen, and I am a super fan. I'm joined by fellow super fan Natalie and newbies Kristen and Brittany. Hello, everyone.
Hi.
Hi.
So my fun fact for this week is that it is February. It is currently like 60 degrees Fahrenheit. I know that means like nothing to you, Natalie. And it's super warm for February. Like, it's spring, and it doesn't make sense. So I actually went outside today, which I don't do often. But today I made an exception.
It was 65 on my break when I went to get lunch this afternoon at work. Like, I got walked out of the building to my car, and I went, oh, my God.
It's insane. Usually we get, like, a lot of snow right now. Like, usually it's freezing.
Yeah.
But it's great. I had fun. There was sunshine. It was lovely. Speaking of lovely, ooh, that was a good transition. Brittany!
That was the best!
Thank you!
Karen gets 10 points. 10 points to Karen.
What's your fun fact, Britt?
That I quit this podcast.
What?
Oh boy, I can't wait. It's the only perk of marriage that's coming is losing the last name. My fun fact is that it is also 65 degrees here in New Jersey, and I did not leave my house. I watched 5 episodes of Feud, which is coming to FX, and yeah, that's what I did today because Newsies was sold out because I waited too long.
Really?
Yeah, I waited for this podcast schedule too long. Should have just
changed my availability. And been like, screw it, I can't do the podcast if it gets in the way of Newsies.
No, I'm going to go during the week. I'm just going to have to leave work early to go, which is kind of a nuisance, but whatever, it's Jeremy Jordan.
Yes.
I saw your tweet about not leaving the house despite the good weather, and I really related to it. I mean, today was, like, different for me. Today, I decided to be a rebel, but normally, I would totally feel you on that level.
I did open my window, so that counts, right? Like,
yeah, definitely.
I could hear totally nature.
Natalie, what's your fun fact?
My fun fact is that when this finishes, I am going to see Newsies because it's only, and I have booked it in advance, because it is only showing for one day in Australia. It's just today. It's not going, I don't think it's going to run for the whole week. But I would just like to rewind for just one second. Brittany, are you actually getting married, or is this like a conceptual future? That's the only reason you'd want to get married is to change your name.
Once again, I should just quit this podcast because it's like you guys don't know me at all. Lovely puns bother me. And no, I'm not getting married. I'm not even dating.
I know. Well, this is right. I know that lovely puns bother you, but just the way that you were like, that's the only good thing about impending marriage. And I was just like, what? Hang on just a second here.
Yeah, a lot has happened in the week that I haven't spoken to you.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. You once posted a picture of you and a guy and said it was your other half. And I was like, is she dating and no one has ever told me this? Or, and like, she likes to keep her life separate? Or is it this like a BFF thing and that I don't understand?
Yeah, no, that would be my gay best friend.
I kind of thought visiting. That. Yeah, see, this is like, I was like 95% sure of this. And then 5% was like, maybe she just likes to keep her entire personal life secret, which is fine. Anyway, no one's getting married just yet on the podcast today. I am going to see Newsies, and I feel really, really, really terrible now. Like, I feel like I want to stab myself in the face because I'm sad that Brittany didn't get to go today.
It's okay. It's playing for 3 days, so I can I could have gone Thursday, today, or Wednesday. So I'm going to go on Wednesday.
Please make sure you do.
I already bought the ticket.
So. Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. Just so everyone knows, well, it's going to be too late by the time you hear this. What we're talking about is a professionally filmed and cinema distributed performance of the Broadway musical Newsies in the way, you know, that I feel like every Broadway musical should be done, at least after it closes, in order to actually circulate that kind of performance to the rest of the world. So this is like, some musicals have done live streams, but this is a full cinema showing, which would be ideal for a lot of other musicals if the industry will agree that this is a way we can get musicals out into the world. So, yeah, I'm very excited. And it's the number one musical I'm sad that I never got to see live with this cast. So I'm very happy. Very happy.
Awesome. And Kristen, what's your fun fact?
My fun fact is that I came home from work today and the book that I have been waiting for, I don't even know, a year and a half, I guess now is how long ago she announced it, was waiting for me. I have a copy of Roar in my hands by Cora Carmack, and I cannot wait to dive in. I have a lot of things I have to finish before I'm allowed to start it, but I now own it, so I'm so excited.
Yay!
Woohoo! I get to read it after you.
Yes, yes, you can read it after me.
All right, let's jump into Buffy now. So we're discussing 5-11 Triangle, and our synopsis from Mitch reads, in this episode, Daddy leaves for London for a bit, so naturally the kids destroy everything in the shop. When Anya and Willow are feuding during some spellcasting, a troll named Olaf from Anya's demon past is unleashed. Olaf is eventually bested by a heart-sick Buffy, but not before all of the glass cases and expensive potions could be destroyed. Good job, guys. So I wanted to start this off with a fun fact that Olaf the Troll is played by Abraham Benrubi, who was on an episode of Bones. I put that in there just for you, Kristen.
I don't know which one. Now I have to go look it up.
Yeah, he was only in one episode. I doubt it was, like, super significant, but he was there. He was also in Robot Chicken with Seth Green, and he played Jerry Markovic? On ER, which I put in there just for you, Brittany.
You're so kind.
I love Jerry.
I do too.
Well, I recognized the troll. Like, his voice kind of stuck out, and I was like, I've seen this guy before. And I was trying to kind of place him and couldn't, but I knew what his face looked like, and then now it makes so much more sense. It's Jerry. Of course, yeah, it's Jerry.
I was like, why do I feel such a kinship and love for this troll? I was like, this is so weird. And now it's all clicking. Like, I didn't bother to look up who played him. I'm just like, oh, this is weird. I normally don't care at all for, like, you know, Monster of the Week characters. But I'm like, there's something about him I really like. And I'm like, oh, now I get it. I just looked up pictures of Jerry and he's so great.
Super fun fact, he and I have the same birthday.
Oh,
like, aw. Not the same year, but the same day. Aw. Olaf the Troll and I. Things we have in common. Yes.
Hopefully that's the only thing you guys have in common. Okay, so let's start
Kristen
off.
Kristen also eats babies. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
Shh. Don't tell everyone my secret.
I haven't noticed yet. Yeah. So, let's start off with kind of a big topic for this one. Willow's "Hello, Gay Now" comment. Mitch is wondering here about bi erasure, and, you know, does she officially define herself as gay? Is she not attracted to men anymore? And is this line always sort of bothered me, because the whole, like, it feels like an on switch to me, whereas the experiences that my friends have had wasn't quite like that. And so I'm really curious what you guys think about this. Natalie, do you want to kick it off?
Yes. I hate this so much. I hate this so much that I hate this character and I hate everything about this storyline. People say it is the most progressive, like, oh my God, you know, assumed straight character becoming queer. First ever done. Oh my God, best queer character. No. Fucking no. Like, I hate this because, okay, yes. They did some stuff. She was straight or whatever, kind of assumed straight, you know, always had a bit something going on. Oh, she met a girl, fell in love with a girl. Yeah, we got to see them be together and kiss and whatever, you know, like, who cares? Okay, that's fine. It was a big deal for the time. But the way it was handled like this is just, to me, just throws that completely out the window. Because, yes, people have very, very, very different experiences. Some people really do have, you know, relationships that they think are legitimate or that they feel attraction, and that they then, you know, discover attraction to, you know, another gender, and then they sort of end up swaying all the way into that. And they really do kind of, I guess, cross over to that. But I feel like Willow's relationships with, you know, her romantic attraction and her relationships with several guys before this point, like before she discovers that, oh, it's also girls, are real. Like, it's you know, her, why, the episode brought up her cheating plot with Xander. That was literally only sexual attraction. I mean, it wasn't only because they'd had such a long friendship, but they were like, oh, I can't stop doing this. Like, it was animalistic want, not just like, oh, I really like you because I've known you for so long. You know, because if it was that, it would have been there the whole time, you know, like, and you know, for her it kind of was, but then they started hooking up and it became more of a, like, we're both in love with other people, but we want each other in the want way. And Oz was a very, very real relationship that she really cherished. And even in the, you know, process of her getting together with Tara, when Oz came back into the picture, it was still really conflicting. This is less than a year later. It's not just like gay now. That's not a thing. That's not a thing. Willow, you are a bisexual woman who has had relationships with men and women, and that is fine. And unless you, in retrospect, like, are saying that those relationships with men were, like, fake, or were like, oh, I didn't realize that it wasn't real at the time, but now I realize that it wasn't real, which it might be. Some people that does happen to, but that's not what they're giving us. What they're giving us is, I'm dating a girl now, therefore I am gay now. And that is so damaging, because, like, the issue of people being bisexual is damaging. It is a problem on both sides. It's a problem of heterosexual people have with bisexual representation, and it's a problem that gay people have with bisexual representations. Both sides really don't like people being bisexual as a thing en masse. Like, there are women, lesbian women, who won't date bisexual women because they don't feel comfortable with the fact that they're also attracted to men. There, you know, there is ones that just say that it's not, you know, basically that they're just trying to have the best of everything. And it's sort of a matter of whether the person you're with at that second in time validates, you know, your entire potential sexuality or not. Like, if Tara was with Willow, if Willow was with Tara and she was planning to stay with Tara for the rest of her life, that's 100% fine. It means she would be in a same-sex lesbian relationship for her entire life. That's totally fine. And, you know, it's understandable for her to be, it's understandable, you know, for her to kind of more identify with that. But to say, yeah, I'm gay now, when she had very real sexual attraction to the same man that we're talking about in question, is, it's not a thing. Like, it's, I find this very, very unacceptable, and I've never, ever liked the way that her stuff is handled. And I don't understand, like, I feel like that this is so much of a roadblock for the potential for characters who are assumed straight to have a more wide sexuality, if that was going to be interesting to the story, or if that was just something that, you know, felt right for the character. Because it doesn't have to be a complete transition from how you originally met them. It's just an increase, as opposed to a, like Karen said, like a full 180 switch. So I don't know. I feel like I've gone a little bit all over the place in this, but I hate this so much, especially for the potential for characters who came into a show as assumed straight and then could have more of a story than that.
Anyone else feel differently?
Sorry.
Or the same?
Everyone's just like, I'm leaving now.
No, I mean,
honestly, I completely understand everything you just said. Like, I agree with you. It makes sense. In the scene and in the moment, I kind of took it as, like, this is how Willow chose to say, like, I like girls. Like, I didn't necessarily think she was saying, like, I will never like a guy ever again. I thought she was just saying, like, hello, I'm gay, like, I'm with this girl. You know, I didn't necessarily think she was, like, announcing her identification there. Like, I thought it was just how she was trying to describe her relationship with Tara in that line or in that moment. So I didn't think anything of it. I totally understand what you mean, and I see it. Like, it makes total sense. But in the moment, like, I just thought she was, like, saying, hey, I'm with her now. That's, you know, things have changed. Like, you know, going on from there.
I guess, but to me, that would still very much be saying, like, oh, you know, you would be like, hey, I'm with someone now. Not that I made a difference when she was with Oz. So it's like, but just being with someone didn't stop her from cheating on that person with Xander. And therefore, like, the other side of that, you know, it not just being, oh, I'm taken, but her being like, huh, I don't do that anymore because boys, lol, is, I don't know, so weird to me and so unhelpful, basically.
Yeah. Like, hearing that line, in addition to, I've been watching a lot of Will and Grace again lately just because I love it. But it made me, there was an episode on the other day from, like, late in the series run in season 7 where, called The Fabulous Baker Boy, where Will has to fire Karen's pastry chef, and the pastry chef is, like, identifies as pansexual, and there's a joke about it with Karen, like, she doesn't understand what that means, so she says, oh my god, he's humping my pans, and
Jesus Christ.
But the point is, like, he sleeps with Will and Karen and Rosario in the episode, and he makes a comment to Will saying, like, I thought you were gay, and he's just like, no, like, I, you know, believe in sexuality, and, like, but Will makes a comment back to him basically being like, yeah, but isn't that just, like, one stop short on, like, you know, the train to Homoville or something like that? And every time I'm watching Will and Grace, I'm like, this would not fly today. Like, for what the show was doing at the time, like, oh my god, like, it's normalized and all this stuff, but it's just, watching it today, I'm like, oh my god, this is so far behind everything that's happening now. And it's really sticking out to me watching it in rerun form, because, you know, I'm thrilled that the show is coming back, and it really did do a lot at the time that it was on, but we've come so far, so I've been thinking a lot, listening to the dialogue that, you know, I'm like, well, this is so dated. Like, it's such a dated show now, and it's just like, what lines could they never, like, or how far basically the show would have to like portray it coming in as not being a product of the late, the early 2000s. And this falls right in the same, you know, time frame. It's a little older than Will and Grace, but that's just been something I've been thinking about, how much of a product of its time it is.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think this is one of those instances where, like, it was a funny line with problematic roots, and maybe they didn't think it all the way through when they had her say it. But Natalie, I think you broke it down pretty specifically.
Yeah, about why, I don't even know.
About why it doesn't really work. But, I mean, the point of this line, and really the point of the whole episode, is that Anya feels threatened by Willow's friendship with Xander, and Willow is worried that Anya is going to end up hurting Xander because she's an ex-demon. And so we learn more about Anya specifically in this episode, but also the dynamic that she has with Willow, which I think is really interesting, because even though they do interact with each other and they have, you know, sniped at each other before, we haven't really seen a confrontation between them in this way. And I think it's about time that it finally happened. So I feel much better that it's sort of out of the way that they work together, that they kind of came to an understanding with each other, and they can still be, you know, Xander's best friend and Xander's girlfriend and get along and not have to worry about one, you know, hurting or taking the other away.
Yeah, I actually wrote down while watching the episode, oh, good, this conflict with Anya and Willow had to happen, and I'm glad it's over. Or it could not be over, but it felt like we've moved past it. Or at least if it does come up again, it won't need a whole episode.
Right, exactly. And on the flip side of that, we do see Xander unable to pick between saving Anya or Willow, which is nice. You know, it would have been really crappy if he had chosen one and then the other would feel, you know, validated in their feelings. How did you guys feel about Xander and him getting his wrist broken over it?
He was better in this than I thought he was, like would be, if you know what I mean. I think that even though I really freaking hated him interfering in Buffy and Riley in the last episode, like, whatever, like, maybe it was true for her and she seemed to be grateful for it, but I was kind of like, this is not your place. Like, if you love Riley so much, Xander, you go marry him. But I did like that confrontation hammered home for him his, you know, how he wanted to treat Anya, which going forward, like, here kind of has a bit of an equal respect. Like, there have definitely been times in the past where he has kind of joined in with the whole, like, yeah, we know, you know, I know that she's ridiculous, but what are you going to do thing? And he actually does kind of seem to get her better now, but then, yeah, it doesn't devalue Willow, and, you know, it is nice. I don't know. I think he did pretty well in this episode.
And nice to see
I'm on
see
Anya's
that...
side in the argument, though.
It's nice to see that he is also loved and that he's also needed and wanted, you know, platonic or otherwise, by other people. Because, of course, like a few episodes ago, we went through the whole thing where he kind of felt like he was useless and everything. And the fact that they're bringing it up again and showing it without the episode being directly about Xander, the episode's really not about Xander at all. It's about Willow and Anya. I just like that they kind of continue to play into that and continue to build up Xander's character as somebody who is maturing and becoming more confident in himself.
Yeah, and without beating us over the head with it.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Newbies, what did you guys think about the little bit of history we learned about Anya, some of her origins? Did you know, other than what we said before, did you like Olaf and did you like hearing that he was the catalyst for her becoming the vengeance demon in the first place?
Well, now I can't stop thinking about Jerry, so I don't believe that Jerry would ever cause someone to become a vengeance demon, but...
Justice for Jerry.
Listen, I've already got my Justice for Tammy campaign. I cannot take on another client at the moment. So I did like getting a little bit more about Anya's origins, but I think I liked it more from the perspective of just all the nonsense she's had to deal with over her years. Like, as a demon, she's like, where she has that bit where she's saying, like, oh, and then so-and-so gets hurt, and then I turn them into this, and then I make someone do that, but all these stupid girls keep going back to the people, and I felt like, okay, Anya, I get you now. Like, her frustration and all of this has been, like, pent up inside her, so every little thing that possibly sets her off, she's like, okay, well, these people are going to want something from me and to fix it by making something else horrible in another person's life, and she's not doing that anymore, and she doesn't have the ability to just, you know, cause someone to, I don't know, ooze whatever out of their eyeballs, but now she, you know, has a job and she just wants to be in a normal life and accept that death is coming for her. Yeah, so even without knowing about, you know, Olaf and that he was that person to get under her skin and kind of really push her to becoming this demon, it was nice to just hear Anya kind of get some stuff off of her chest in general.
I think my favorite part of all of this was, like, she was like, no, Willow, this is all your fault. You're the one who released him. It's all your fault. And then, like, 2 seconds later, you find out that she's the one who created him. It's like, oh, yeah, it's kind of everybody's fault. Like, that was more what I loved about all of it, is that just when you think, you know, Anya's telling you the whole truth, actually, I know this troll.
What I really liked about this episode, like, with Anya especially, is it kind of did, yeah, like Brittany said, put some perspective on her behavior, in that, you know, you're taking into account that she's lived for 1,000 years. That's older than Angel, Spike, that's older than Darla, that's, you know, nearly as old as the Master or more. She's very blunt, and she doesn't really understand society and stuff like that. And we see a lot of that in this episode. We see, you know, Willow trying to put human rules and you know, societal behaviors onto her. It's like, you don't play by these rules. And it's like, yeah, well, she's lived for 1,000 years. And in that time, I'm pretty sure that she has just gotten to the point of cutting through the crap. As in, like, there is literally not time to dilly-dally and gameplay. I mean, there's lots of time, but, like, after living so much and seeing so much and seeing so much nonsense, you know, you wouldn't even bother with anything except cutting through. Cutting through the crap. You can see people very clearly. You know, you can understand people very clearly, and she basically just doesn't waste energy on, you know, the game playing that gets us through our normal little human lives, because that's not something she had to worry about, or that's sort of something she got past. And, you know, like, you know, the difference between, you know, like, have a nice day and please leave, you know, like, even just down to stuff like that. She doesn't, like, waste a single word where she doesn't have to, because she has basically lived through more than anyone else they know, and has just sort of come out with what is actually important on top. And when she does express her real concerns, she always expresses them very clearly, and expresses the why, you know, like, the why behind them. And I really love her for that. And I didn't feel like the argument between her and Willow was comparable. Like, yes, she made the troll however long ago, they didn't know that he was in that crystal, you know. But I think that her argument with, like, hey, don't, like, steal stuff from Giles's supplies and then, like, not tell him about it if it goes wrong, like, you know, don't do those things, that is wrong. And I don't think that, like, Willow's griping back at her about her, you know, societal behavior is actually comparable to Willow doing this stuff that she knows she potentially shouldn't be doing without Giles there. I don't know. I was so on her side. Not that I think that Xander made a bad decision, or, like, should have let Willow die or anything like that. But in terms of the little gripes, I don't think, you know, I don't see Willow's perspective at all. And I 100% see Anya's, but she is, you know, someone I have been compared to fairly often. But so maybe I'm biased, but I don't know. Like, Willow seemed much more petty than Anya's side did.
Yeah, I get that. I understand where Willow is coming from to an extent, because I think that it is a little frustrating to be working with someone like Anya, where Willow is still, I mean, she's better than she was, but she's quite sensitive. So I can understand that having to deal with somebody like Anya can be very difficult. But at the same time, I do think that these characters forget that Anya has lived so long, and forget that she... You're right. She's seen so much. She's been through so much. She's tired of the crap that people go through, especially when you consider that the same women would be coming back to her time and time again, wanting vengeance, you know, people making the same mistake. You just get tired of it after a while. So I definitely have a lot of sympathy for Anya.
Yeah. Like, there's only so much, you know, of 1,000 years that you would give mm-hmm. to social niceties and be like, you know, instead of just being like, look, we're just not going to waste energy with this. We're just going to tell it like it is, because in the long run, who cares or whatever? In the long run, it gets stuff done, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
So Willow brings up Rat Amy again in this episode. And Kristen, I know you really liked this scene in particular.
Well, I just got very excited for Mitch. I was like, oh my God, Mitch is going to be so excited. Like, and it seriously is like, just as soon as we sort of think they've forgotten about it, she pops back in a scene or we hear about her or something. So they are aware that Amy is still a rat and she is still hanging around and Willow's still trying to figure out how to free her.
Mm-hmm. And convinced that she has to come back now. So do you guys agree with that? Do you think Rat Amy is going to be a thing or do you think it's just this long running gag that's never really going to pay off?
Oh, series finale. I love if it's a long running gag that never pays off. And like, you know, something huge happens right before they cut to black in the series finale. And Amy just like comes and back and Rat Amy form and is like, what is going on?
Yeah, I'm expecting series finale for Rat Amy to become human again. That's the only solution.
Okay, well,
a couple more seasons. The end credits, the post-end credits scene of the series finale of Buffy.
You guys don't know this yet, but there is a Rat Amy spinoff show. Sorry, had to ruin it for you guys.
Just so you know, we didn't want to spoil it, but, you know, we'll be covering that on Rewatchable as well, so you're strapped in for another year.
So now my fun fact has turned into a real fact. I am quitting Rewatchable.
But Brittany, we love you so much. Please don't leave.
All right. As soon as Angel is back to being normal Angel, then I'll leave. He's too good to give up right now.
Oh my God. It sucks.
I'm glad you
Let's
feel that.
Let's carry on.
Yeah. So switching gears, we also have Buffy, obviously, in this episode, though it didn't super focus on her, but she's dealing with the fact that Riley left. And it was really interesting for me this episode because she kind of starts off as like very mature and she's like, yes, I'm upset that he left. And, you know, I do hope that he comes back. She has a really great discussion with Dawn. She has a great discussion with Giles. But she's dealing with it and she's trying to move on. And then throughout the episode, she's talking to Tara and she's talking to the others when she's fighting with the troll. And she just starts crying. And I think it's meant to be funny. And it was funny. But I can never remember, honestly, if she's joking or not. Because when she was talking to Giles, she's like, the world is ending. I'm just kidding, sort of. And, you know, she kind of plays up the whole heartbroken thing because she's done that before with Angel. She was devastated. And I'm like, wait, are you actually crying or are you playing a joke on these people to show them that you're actually okay?
No, it was real, but it also reminded me of the kind of melodrama she has when she's, like, bewitched or something, like when in, like, a... not Yoko Factor, in Something Blue and stuff like that. Like, the kind of, like, comedy slapstick crying, if you know what I mean. Yeah. I'm like, no, this is just Buffy's actual personality when she isn't being weighed down by being the Slayer. She is a ditzy idiot. And this is what comes out when she actually gets the chance to be Buffy Summers, teenage girl, instead of Buffy Summers, the Vampire Slayer. She's really not that, like, she's not that cool or calm or even deep when she is not being the Slayer. And this was that total kind of like, this is Buffy's actual personality getting to shine through, like her actual personality that isn't weighed down by the weight of the world. And I hate it so much, basically. That was my experience of Buffy in this episode. Sorry.
I was going to say, it's very jarring because she's been so strong and so mature for the last, like, you know, season or so. And especially dealing with her mother, she's really stepped it up. And I've really enjoyed seeing the more mature side of her. And at the top of the episode, when she is dealing with it and she admits that she's sad, but she's going to try to move on, that's the Buffy I really appreciate. And then it kind of just gets ridiculous after that. But newbies, I wanted to know if you guys thought it was funny, if you thought it was stupid, if you didn't really care.
I thought it was cute. Honestly, like, her mother just almost died. And then she decided that she was going to love Riley forever and ran after him and didn't make it in time. Like, that's a lot of emotional turmoil to go through in, like, a week. Like, she's been through so much that it doesn't surprise me that she's like a little over emotional sometimes. And that's literally how I read those. I mean, yes, it was a little over the top even for that. But like, I read it as like, she's seeing this thing who's trying to break up her friends who are in love, and she's just not okay with it. And so she's going, you know, like that whole thing, it just worked for me. I don't know. I thought it was funny. It's cute. I just thought it was Buffy kind of like having a few mood swings that she just couldn't quite pull herself together yet. She's getting there.
I feel like it could have been done in a way that would have made it a little less, like, a little less ridiculous. Like, because it did feel like, oh my God, is she under a comedy spell for me for a hot second? And then I was like, no, no, this is just her being Buffy.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
I feel like right here we should put in some, like, CNN breaking news music, because I thought all of her reactions were perfectly rational.
Oh! Oh my God!
And I was fine with it, because I think that exactly what Kristen was saying, she is not only trying to figure out, like, you know, how to solve this Glory thing. She has Dawn to take into consideration. She knows that they don't know what is coming after Dawn, but they know eventually she's going to be at risk. Her mother's at home, like, you know, living in a bathrobe, and Riley left, but she doesn't know how she feels about Riley, because she never did. She never gave herself completely over to that relationship, because they were either fighting someone, or then her mom got sick, and now she kind of feels guilty because, you know, he was more invested when she wasn't. And then, you know, you got this creepy vampire going through your house and stalking you and trying to, like, catch your eye all the time, and she's got to deal with that. And then she's got her friends, and Giles left, and it's a lot. Plus school. Like, she's going to school, too. So,
which you kind of forget about sometimes.
Yeah, and so then when she's talking, and this is my favorite scene, but when she's talking to Tara, and they're, like, going through classes and stuff like that, it made so much sense to me in that moment that that was when she was going to cry and be upset. And it was with the person you least expect, and over, like, a conversation that started about, like, I don't know what classes I'm going to take. Because, yeah, at that moment, the classes are what's going to push you over the edge, because they're so inconsequential. Like, what is your degree going to do when there's no Sunnydale or World? Because it's overtaken by demons. So, yeah, no, I totally got Buffy in this episode, which is a weird thing, I know, but I'm totally with Kristen, where these conversations didn't, like, the acting felt overacting, but I feel like on the page, it made, everything was justified and made sense.
Even they have a miraculous love.
See, aren't you glad you didn't quit the show, Brittany? Then you could never have this time to admit that you actually loved Buffy once.
Once.
Just once. Somebody you do like, though, is Giles. And Giles had, he kind of stepped away a little bit in this episode when he went to visit the Watchers Council and basically informed them of Glory, which they had no ideas about, and let them know that there is a key that will, that she's looking for. And so, what do you guys think the Watchers Council's going to do? Do you think they're going to be helpful? Do you think they're going to screw everything up? Do you think that they're just going to stand by and let Buffy deal with it all?
I think the only reason we heard about the Watchers Council was so that Giles would leave and we could have this episode. Like,
yeah.
I don't think they're going to be helpful at all. I think it's literally a running joke now that the Watchers Council is terrible. Like, they don't know anything. They're not helpful. It's like they needed to kind of try it out. Like, they were giving them one more shot. Like, maybe they'll know something. And since he came back with no answers and basically just gave them something else to look at, I have a feeling the Watchers Council will never be helpful again.
Yeah, and why do you jump on a plane? And, like, maybe he was meeting up with his lover in the UK, and that's why he really had to go to the UK. But you know, why don't you just go and see Wesley first? He's right there. Maybe he knows something. Like, why isn't that the first person you call out? Like, he's local. You could probably find him in the phone book under Angel Investigations. Or you could just drive there. It's not far. And ask him, do you think it's a good idea to go to the Watchers Council? This is what's going on. But, you know, these shows can only overlap when it's convenient for Buffy and Angel. Ugh, I was so frustrated. So frustrated that he could not just call Wesley.
Just a phone call to Cordy. Cordy's in has been in touch with Willow before.
Yeah.
A phone call to Cordy. Hey, Cordy, when you get a chance, tell Wesley to give me a call. I have a question for him. Come on. It's not that hard.
It's a fair point.
Is Wesley kicked out of the Watchers now, though? Like, does he have any contacts?
Not even that he would have.
No. Is he a reject?
Yeah, but it's not even that he would have contact. It's more so, like, is it worth my while to go and even bother with this? Like, they both know what is there. Wesley was there more recently than Giles was.
Yeah.
So
also, we have phones. Like, he could have, anyway. Yeah, like, if he was going to call Wesley, he could have freaking called England. But yeah, we clearly needed him out of the way so they could trash the shop.
You know? Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even more so than that, I think that this whole trip also not only served for us to see the shop trashed, to be reminded that the Watchers Council sucks, but also so Dawn can finally learn that she's the key. Now, I don't think she necessarily understands the whole context of the situation because they didn't exactly spell it out, but she knows something's up with her and she knows that they all know this and haven't told her. So how do you guys think that she's going to react to that?
My first instinct was going to be that, like, my first thought before we saw her face was that she'd be a little upset because they're talking about her behind her back and she doesn't know. But, like, I kind of thought she'd be a little excited to, like, have a role in all of this and not to be on the outside. Like, she's talked a lot about being left behind, and we see her kind of get depressed when they don't include her and stuff. And so I kind of honestly thought that her first instinct would be, I can't believe they haven't told me, but then, like, okay, but I'm special too. Like, I, you know, I might not be a Slayer, but there's something about me that's special too. So until she knows exactly what the key is and how she came to be and the fact that maybe she didn't exist on another, you know, in another world, in another reality, like, that would all be incredibly jarring. But I expected in this instance for her to kind of maybe be happy about it.
I don't know. I think she's going to become annoying again and in a justifiable way. Like, you know, oh, well, you're not telling me everything, so I'm going to, like, give you the silent treatment. Because she is young still, mm-hmm. and this is a lot to hear and take on. And, like, now she might even feel more isolated. Like, oh, now it's me against them. They all are in on this. Like, before, it was just Buffy running over to her little clan and, you know, clique that she was never quite a part of. But now her mother, who was the only person on her side for a while, and she just started getting Buffy back, but now both of them are with Giles and incorporated into something, and it's about her, and she doesn't know what's going on, so I'm thinking she's probably scared, and then also feeling like, oh, well, what am I going to do now if no one's telling me?
Yeah, I think those are both reasonable reactions, especially for a young teenager who has to deal with all of this.
And given that she's already had so many episodes, you know, in the past few weeks of getting upset about, like, the crazy people telling her that she's not real and stuff, I'm sure that this will make her feel super awesome about that as well.
Yeah. So the last part of the episode I wanted to talk about is a question that I have for you guys. I'm really interested in hearing what you have to say about this, actually, because we see Spike helping Buffy take care of the people that were injured when Olaf the troll cut down the stage and, you know, everything fell on them and they were bleeding and everything. And Spike's putting a jacket under a woman's head. And I want to know, do you guys think, should Spike be given credit for not feeding off of the disaster victims? Buffy obviously thinks he's disgusting no matter what, and that that idea is just ridiculous. But I wanted to know what you guys thought.
Yes, he should be given some credit for not eating the disaster victims, but that credit is going to then be taken away because he shows off about it. Like, you know, he's, like, making a show of the fact that he is not draining all of these innocent people of their blood and, you know, making, like, making sure the woman's head is taken care of. The only thing I did appreciate that did it, like, made it a little bit more okay in my mind was that when Buffy walked away and was clearly still disgusted, he continued to help.
Yeah, he wasn't like, just like, well, screw this, exactly. I'm not going to try anymore. Yeah,
which is what I was expecting him to do.
Yep.
So when he didn't do that, I was like, okay, it made it a little bit better. Because as it was happening, I was like, Spike, oh my gosh, like I'm giving you a lot of room to work this Buffy situation out, but you're coming close to crossing a line with making me annoyed. And then he stayed and helped. And I was like, okay, well, yes, you used it to show off, but you didn't just be like, ah, forget it and walk away after she didn't care about what you were doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's basically one step from yelling, notice me, yes. Notice me.
And throwing a box of chocolates at her.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, this ties pretty heavily into my favorite line, actually, which I don't know if I'll just talk about now or whatever. But if you're asking the question, I think that everything going on with Spike, and obviously I don't want to, like, spoil too much, but I think that everything going on with Spike, he, you know, him and Xander, you know, they hang out and they play pool at the venue, and that's why they're there when the disaster happens. And basically Spike's hanging on to this kind of thing about, you know, he's shown Riley, you know, he's shown Buffy Riley and you know, he showed her that situation and she wasn't grateful and he's upset that he's hurt her because of it, because his first instinct was like, oh, you know, she needs to know this is bad for her and maybe she'll like me better if I, you know, show her that something that she needs to know, or maybe she'll, you know, get him out of the way so I can be look better and stuff like that. And we were watching this and Leo actually pointed out something to me really interesting, which was that, like, those actions would totally work if he was dealing with another person who didn't have a soul. Like, if he was trying to woo another vampire or something like that, those kind of things, those kind of, hey, appreciate me for this, like, hey, I've shown you that I'm better than him, or I'm shown you that, like, you know, he's screwed you over, those kind of things would probably work on, like, someone, you know, like another vampire who'd be like, oh, you know, you're my hero, or oh, you're so strong, I don't know, something. And he is currently in this position of being really upset that he's hurt her with this, like, he's hurt her with, and upset and angry because he doesn't have a soul and he doesn't know how to process emotions. And I've said before that his heart is super pure, but it's getting messed around by the fact that the rest of him has no processing and choice-making skills that are ingrained in right and wrong. So his, you know, his love might be real and it might be for the right reasons, but everything that shows him, that tells him how to show that, he has absolutely no processing skills for it. And that's why he's in his house sniffing panties. That's why he's stealing photos of her. That's why he's losing his shit, you know, trying to give her chocolates and then beating up the dummy and then being like, nope, start again until I can do this without beating the dummy, you know, like, and in that conversation with Xander, you know, he's kind of passive aggressively being like, you know, oh, getting angry at the innocent bystander who was, you know, don't shoot the messenger. And then he says, what does the person have to do to make it right? Because he has no processing skills at all of what actually counts as right, or what counts as selfless, or what counts as being worth something. He's doing what, you know, he feels at the moment like would be the right thing to do, and for the right reasons, but he's only just starting to learn what that is. And that question, what does a person have to do to make it right, is the most important question for Spike's
arc from here on out, basically. So that, you know, that is the question, basically, for him and how he feels about Buffy, is what does someone have to do to prove that they are worth anyone's time? And the whole disaster victim thing, the difference, you know, it's kind of like the Snape situation of, like, was he doing what he was doing purely, you know, to, you know, he didn't care morally either way, but he was doing it because it was, you know, on the side that Lily took. And then he, you know, eventually came to believe in that himself, or did he never believe in it himself? And it was still all based in, like, oh, that's the side that I, you know, I don't care about the morals, but I care about what she would have wanted. Or do those situations turn into, hey, I started doing this for this reason, but now I've actually learned why I believe it for myself, or I've remembered how to be a good person again, or whatever. So I think that Spike, you know, continues to help because he's learning how to be a person again. But it's just something Buffy, you know, Buffy has absolutely no faith or belief that that's even possible. So I think he should be given some credit. Some credit, but he was very doing it, you know, because he's trying to look good to her. And I guess the question is that good enough? Like, is being good enough, or do you have to be good for the right reasons, or the certain reasons, if you know what I mean?
I think that it's really important to remember that this is a process for Spike. I also think he should be given some credit, but I think you guys are right to point out the fact that he was definitely doing it for Buffy, not for the right reasons. That being said, like, Spike might have a chip in his head, but he's still evil. So this is very interesting territory for a vampire, and he's not going to get it right the first time, and he's probably not going to get it right the second, third, or fourth time either. It's very much a process, and I really appreciate seeing him take those stepping stones on the path to potentially being a good person down the line. Because if it happened instantaneously, it wouldn't be fulfilling. It would be like, okay, what happened here? You know, was there a magic spell that all of a sudden made him a good guy? No, he's doing this because in his own twisted way, he really does care about Buffy, and he's making an effort. That effort might not always be good enough, but the fact that he's making it to begin with is very interesting.
Just again, that his feelings are real and his feelings are good. It's just that everything that comes with being a vampire, you know, a soulless vampire, means that the way that he operates on those feelings is intrinsically not good. And there's a lot of people who, you know, don't find what he does forgivable, like, you know, the stuff that it's, you know, only for that selfish reason, or, you know, that, oh, it's creepy, it's stalkery and stuff like that. Yes, it is. It 100% is. It's weird and it's uncomfortable and it's not cute or, you know, anything like that. But it is cute and lovely and inspiring watching him combat his own evil. Like, you know, he's acting on his impulses, the way that his impulses are telling him to love now, but once he realizes that that is not actually going to be good or work or be healthy, it is, you know, watching him try is worth some sort of redemption, I think. So yeah,
definitely agree. Okay, let's jump into our favorite scenes now. Brittany, you've already told us yours, Tara and Buffy's chat. So let's, Natalie, let's go to you to kind of continue the Spike theme.
Oh, again, I already sort of mentioned it, but it was when he was, with the creepy doll that he keeps in his house to talk to, dressed up like Buffy. Again, problem. He practices his speech that he wants to apologize for upsetting her about showing her Riley, that she, you know, he didn't want to hurt her. You know, he's sad it was the cause of hurting her, then he kind of predicts in his head how she's going to respond and, you know, gets angry in response to that and ends up beating up the dummy with his box of chocolates. And then he kind of picks it all up, starts again so that he can try and do this without beating her up and no matter how she responds to him. And we kind of just see the start of that process. And the fact that he sort of I kind of picked this because it reminds me of Zuko in the forest rehearsing how he's going to talk to the gang in season 3 when he wants to go join them. And yeah, so that was one reason. But yeah, it's just that's the kind of thing that I mean. Like if it had ended with just him beating up the doll, that would be one thing. But the fact that that scene ends with him like calming himself down and starting again, that he's actually trying to get past reacting like that is really interesting to me.
Yeah, I completely agree. Kristen, what's your favorite scene?
Mine is when it's completely ridiculous. When Willow starts the spell to like create this sunlight ball thing and just like walks away and leaves it mid spell to like go fight with Anya. Like, it's so a plot device. Like, you can see what's happening and what's coming. Like, you know that this is going to happen. But it was just so funny, like, as this troll appears and they're like, you did it. No, you did it. No, you did. Like, that just got me. I thought it was cute. So, yes, it's a total plot device, but I bought into it and I liked it.
I'm actually on the other end of the spectrum there. My favorite scene was when Willow and Anya finally start working together, because I think they're always going to have a little bit of a rivalry between each other. I don't think that their personalities mesh that well, but in the end, they did start working together and they kind of congratulated each other. And you knew it was coming the whole time that eventually they would be friends or at least kind of drop what their issues were once they got it out into the open. But it was nice to see it anyway. I liked it. Okay, favorite lines now. Again, Natalie, we've already done yours. So, Kristen, let's jump to yours.
Sure. Mine is, of course, an exchange because I can never just pick one line of anything. And it's between Xander and Buffy. And Xander says, so how goes the slaying? And Buffy says, I killed something in a convent last night. And Xander says, in any other room, a frightening declaration. Here, a welcome distraction. Tell us about the killing, Buff. And Buffy says, pretty standard, vampire staking. Oh, but I met a nun and she let me try on her wimple. And Xander says, okay, now we're back to frightening. Just the fact that we saw her talking to this nun, but, like, the fact that she got to try on her wimple and was like, I can see it. From where that scene started, like, I can totally see it. But
now she has a new best friend, a nun, who she goes and, like, visits on random occasions.
Good times.
Yeah. Brittany, what was your favorite line?
My favorite line was the longest run-on sentence ever from Anya. And she is trying to put her feelings about Riley leaving into, like, terms that Xander will understand and also, like, show her fear of, you know, what could possibly happen to their relationship. And so she's basically telling him, you know, don't leave. Like, let's talk it out. Even if the world is ending, like, just don't walk away. And so she says, if you ever decide to go, I want a warning, you know, big flashing red lights and one of those clocks that counts down like a bomb in the movie. And there's a whole bunch of colored wires and I'm not sure which one is the right one to cut, but I guess the green one. And then at the last second, no, the red one. And then click, it stops with 0.3 seconds left, but then you don't leave like that. Okay. So just like her frazzledness. And like I said earlier, I really appreciated getting this insight into her character a little bit more.
That's cool. That's awesome. My favorite line was from Spike, and it's just when he's being an asshole, but he says, yeah, I could do that, but I'm paralyzed with not caring very much. And it was just a great line, typical Spike moment, and I had to write it down. All right, let's get into Angel episode 211 redefinition now. In this episode, Angel Lou is out in full swing.
I understand this joke.
It's not quite Angel. It's not quite Angelus. So it's
okay.
Angelou. It's Angelou. Oh, I said it wrong the first time.
Oh my God. Okay. Yeah.
So in this episode, Angelou is out in full swing, ready to burn down any fool who crosses his path. When Darla and When Darla and Drew try to get an army together to take over LA, Angel stops them in their tracks by lighting the ladies on fire. Meanwhile, Cordy, Wes, and Gunn decide to continue running Angel investigations, and both Lila and Lindsay are promoted as co-division leads. So, fun fact for this episode, which I did not realize, although in hindsight, very obvious, Angel does not speak aloud in this episode, only in voiceover.
Really? Even in the end scene with the fire?
Yep. Never says a word except in voiceover.
I hated the voiceover so much. I hated this stylistically so much. Interesting.
See, I sort of felt like they were making fun of themselves with the voiceover. Like, it's cheesy that they know how cheesy it is. And it especially worked on me because last night, Karen and I went and saw the Lego Batman movie.
Yes.
And this, like, it felt like Angel was trying to be like Christian Bale's moody Batman. Like, I'm so sad. I'm here in the darkness, all about my darkness. Like, that is exactly what this episode was. And I was like, oh my God, like the timing for this could not have been better. So I actually really liked the voiceover in that it was just ridiculous.
That's interesting to me because the reason I really struggled to watch like Arrow, the current CW Arrow, which I know that you guys like, Kristen, and I don't know if Karen watches it. Mm-hmm. It was because I was like, he sounds like Lego Batman. I can't take him seriously because he reminds me of Lego Batman. So I do feel that.
That's fair. That's pretty fair, to be honest.
Definitely fair.
But speaking of Angelou, do you newbies think that he's going to be the season 2 big bad? Do you think we're going to have to see the trio combat Angel in the end?
No.
No.
I mean, I kind of feel like he knows where he is. Like, he knows he's dark, but he's doing it for a reason. Like, he's kind of doing this because he knows there's no other way to take these two down and he can't let them, like, run around and kill people. Like, by the end of the episode, when Wesley, like, comes down and tells him that they're going to keep going, like, the way Angel, like, didn't react to it, it almost felt like, yeah, I know what I'm doing. Like, like, he's not himself. Angel knows that he's going to a dark place, but, like, he knows he just kind of has to be there. So yeah, I don't think he's going to have himself to be saved. Yeah.
Yeah. He is. All he's doing is purging himself of human emotion and normal behavior. You know, like can't have all of these, you know, friends around making me feel like I'm normal. I've got to actually just cut everything out except, you know, base instinct killing machine stuff in order for me to be able to do this. Because if I let myself be an emotional person and think about it, I'm not going to be able to kill Darla and Drew. Like, I can't bring myself to do it. So what, you know, he's doing is basically just making himself into a thoughtless weapon because if his emotions come into play, he's not going to be able to get the job done. And he talks in that voiceover about, you know, oh, wolf from an heart, kill from afar. I don't have that. I don't have that power. Like, I can't do that. And to me, that was really interesting in terms of that it felt like he was talking about emotion. He's like, I am literally going to have to get in their face and kill them, and I can't do it. And it's interesting then the you know, contrast to the end where he does try to kill them with that removal of, like, not actually going up to their body and staking them, you know? Like, so I found that really, really interesting. Maybe that's not what it's meant to mean. Maybe it's not about, like, the emotional connection, but that's definitely how I was taking it.
Yeah, it felt more like a, you know, underneath the, when at the end of the last episode, underneath the you're fired, it was more of a, like, I'm doing this for your own good. Like, it without some, like, being so on the nose with, like, you know, winking at them, like, hey, you know, I'm doing, like, the right thing for you guys in this moment, even though you can't see it. And
yeah,
it just reminds me, so I've been waiting for Trainspotting to come out here, so I've watched every single interview that the cast has done up until this point, and Robert Carlyle had a great
like, you just made me think of it. He, in an interview, he was saying, you know, everyone keeps asking them, it's been 20 years, what's it like to go back into these characters? And he plays Begbie, who's like this guy who's completely off his rocker. Like, he is insane. And he's just getting out of prison for 20 years at the start of this film. And so he said to them, he's like, well, once you're in Begbie's head, you can't get out of it immediately. So while we were filming, I didn't go home. He's like, I couldn't risk bringing any of Begbie home into, like, where my children are. And so it's, like, the same thing with Angel. Like, he can't risk bringing any of that into his, like, you know, little sphere of friends, because what if Cordelia just happens to get in the way? Angel knows that he can't control something that could happen once he's there and knows what he needs to do and knows what needs to be done. She could be, like, you know, collateral damage, and he doesn't want that. So he's, like, just cutting it all off and, you know, hoping that they understand that and putting the trust in them, really, that they are getting the fact that they shouldn't go after him, you know?
Yeah, I think that is an excellent point, actually. And I think we need to remember that even though Darla is sort of new, and even though Drusilla is very insane, they are formidable foes. And the reason why Angel is pushing everyone away, and the reason why he's training and he's going after them methodically, is because they pose a huge threat. And I like that, first of all, because it's cool to have two female villains working together and being, you know, just unleashing chaos. But I kind of wanted to gauge how you guys felt about them and what they're doing right now, if you see them as formidable foes for Angel, and what you think they're actually up to.
I think you brought up a great point in the way that you phrased it, is that they're new to us, but this threat is very well known to Angel. Mm-hmm. And I don't even think it's well known to Wolfram and Hart. I think they're too new to even understand it. But Angel knows what they're capable of and knows what's going through their head and understands the process of coming back as a vampire and then losing that connection and then, you know, going through this, like, emotional turmoil that Darla's now in, and now she's, like, hell-bent on something. And so I don't think I could guess, if you paid me $1 million, if I was correct, to figure out what they're up to at this point, besides recruiting people and what their ultimate end game is. But it's something that Angel understands is very real, and it's not just something that him getting together with Darla might be, which is, I think, what a lot of people were throwing at him, including Wesley and Cordelia. All they kept saying was, oh, all of this over a girl, all of this over another blonde girl. And he's trying to not get angry with them, but also, like, let them know that, like, listen, this isn't a love thing anymore. Like, yeah, there's that element in play, but what they're about to do is not going to be solved by me sleeping with Darla. Like, it's not, that's not what's going to make this all go away. So, or maybe it is, and if it is, I'll be really disappointed in the Angel writers. But yeah, I really don't know what they're up to, but I really like the idea that we're coming in and the same kind of knowledge as Cordelia and Wesley, where we're like, okay, yeah, they're, like, kind of threatening, but they're newish, you know, but Angel is taking this with all of his experience.
Yeah, he is definitely uniquely qualified to know exactly what they're dealing with here. Nobody else is going to get it, and he knows that, so it's, you know, it's on him. He's the one who has to take them down, whatever they're planning. And I agree, there's no way to know what those two have up their sleeve. Like, they're crazy enough that it could be anything. So yeah, I'm not even going to try to guess what the plan is, but it's going to be bad. That much I can pretty much guarantee.
And the question here about Darla, whether or not she'll decide to be sort of a good, maybe, like, you know, neutral but still soulless vampire. And I think that this is an interesting question because we know that she didn't really want to become a vampire again in the end. Like, she had decided, this is it. I'm okay with what's happened. Let's just kind of get over this. And she was coerced into it. And when she woke up, it was very frightening, which we've seen with vampires before. And it's very disorienting. But now she's sort of taken up the normal Darla reigns and she's causing chaos, and she is a very intelligent person, and I think that makes her extremely dangerous. I think Drusilla is dangerous because she's insane, and I think Darla is dangerous is because she's very calculating. Do you think she ever would decide to kind of take a step back, or do you think like the end is going to be if and when Angel kills her?
I mean, I think if Angel was able to put Drusilla down and somehow Darla, like, had time to get away from her and to, like, take a step back and think about everything, I think she has the capability to be a Spike-like character where she has a lot of, you know, vampire badness in, you know, in her, but can still, like, care and can still be a functional being in the world. But I don't necessarily think that that's where this is going. Like, she has tapped into the side of herself that had, you know, that was in charge all those years ago when she was dragging Angel around, you know, from place to place, and they were, you know, killing everyone in sight. That's the Darla that's in control right now. And I don't know if you can get her to a place where she can, like, switch mindsets again. I just don't know if right now she's capable of it.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think that the show has definitely the capability of writing Darla into a character who could be eventually find herself in the fold of being an Angel regular once all this is resolved. I do think Drusilla needs to go, but I also think that to make Angel a more interesting character and to really dig deep into, like, his history and where the show could go in the future, I think that he needs to personally stake both of them. Because Wolfram and Hart is always going to be an ongoing threat because we're still not really sure what their deal is. But, yeah, I think it would be a good move for the show to eventually kill both of them and make Angel do it.
And speaking of Wolfram and Hart, were either of you guys surprised that both Lila and Lindsay survived?
No, I think it was once it got to that resolution, I think it was a good move because Lindsay, I feel like, needs that kind of push. He needs someone to compete against, and I think it's going to make both of their characters a little bit more interesting, you know, to see where the push and pull is and who can work with success as an incentive and who is really just living in fear. And it really, I think it'll push Lindsay to test his loyalties because, yeah, he was tested a little bit more in this episode, but I think if you really left him alone and he continued to climb, you know, I think he needs that constant pressure on him without just, you know, getting these handouts. So it'll be interesting to see where his character goes. I know no one likes him, but, oh, Natalie does. Natalie likes him, right?
Lindsay?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do.
I was trying to think of our 200th episode. I was like, no. I know there was someone really fighting for him not to die in that game. And it was Natalie.
Me.
Yeah. I definitely thought Lindsay was going to survive because I figured he's been enough of a player in the show that if he's going to die, we're going to see it. Like, they're not going to just have him die off camera and ta-da, Lindsay's gone. We'll never see him again. Like, he's been a major player. So I assumed we'd see him again. I was a little surprised Lila survived. I agree with Brittany that the way they did it works really well because these two are so competitive that it's that's going to work in our favor for like future stories and stuff. But yeah, I was a little surprised Lila survived, but not upset about it. Like, I'm glad she's around to kind of keep Lindsay on his toes.
Oh yeah, no, I was thinking more of like their standoff. So yeah, obviously I'm still not surprised that Lindsay and Lila survived at this point, but my shock response that I was talking about was more of whether or not they were going to kill one another or someone was going to kill one or the other. But coming out of the close of the just complete massacre, I thought maybe like Lindsay got out, not that he would be pulled from under all the bodies. but I wasn't surprised that he survived in that moment or in the kind of like push and pull of the whole episode where, you know, they were kind of like, well, there's a 50-50 shot of one of us surviving.
Yeah, I mean, especially because Lindsay has sort of gotten a point of view on the show in a way that Lila hasn't. So we've sort of followed his story. It's kind of tricked us a few times to kind of feeling a little compassionate for him. It makes sense that he's made it this long. But what I find even more interesting than that is we're halfway through season two, and Wolfram and Hart is still sort of the overarching big bad right now. Is this surprising to you guys? Do you feel like they could continue with this? Do you think it'll possibly be resolved by the end of season two? Do you think it can go on to season three? Do you want it to go on to season three? Because they've been around for a while now.
We still don't know, like, the powers above Lindsay and the other guy that died, who I never really knew his name, the head guy.
Holland?
Like, we don't.
Is his name Holland?
Holland, yes, thank you. We haven't really met the people above them. Like, they keep talking about them and how they're these, you know, formidable people and, you know, we have to please them and all that. But we still don't know, like, who's pulling all the strings down here. So I'm assuming that they'll be around for a while, and I'm fine with that because you've got the powers that be on one side pulling all of Cordy and Angel strings, and if you've got this other, you know, evil formidable force on the other side, like, eventually you would hope that those would come into play against each other, and that could be really cool. So
yeah, I don't think that they're going anywhere, mainly because they're not giving us anything really with Wolfram and Hart. I feel like they keep making up positions that are supposed to seem like promotions. I'm like, how much higher can you go? How many levels of management are in your pyramid? Like, so yeah, I think as long as they can keep coming up with clever titles to keep giving Lindsay or anyone who comes in who's not actually like head honcho, then they have plenty of staying power, because right now they're still a mystery. Like, we know they have multiple dealings with different types of, you know, demons and all sorts of walks of life. So I think the potential for their bank of connections within the universe of Angel is not close to running out anytime soon.
And there's certainly an interesting collective villain versus a monster of the week or the master, who ended up being, you know, the big bad of season one. It's not like they're one person. It's not like they necessarily have one objective. Maybe they do have one big objective, but they kind of go about it by breaking it down and compartmentalizing everything. And I think that makes it interesting. Although I have to say that, like, the constant, okay, let's take one more step in this episode, does make it feel a little slow and does make me want to be like, okay, let's just get to whatever the heck's going on so we can solve this mystery. So sometimes I'm kind of both minds.
Yeah, but you know what it made me think of the whole time you were talking and I couldn't wait to tell you was in, like, we haven't seen Hades yet, but meanwhile he's just throwing all this stuff at, like, Hercules, like, you know, in that montage where he's, like, yeah, pushing all of the creatures at him. So it's sort of like that, but we're probably never going to get the montage is five seasons of Angel set to the sappy cello score that I don't listen to. Instead of Zero to Hero.
I just really like that you made that comparison. Thank you, Brittany.
Yeah, no problem.
I think it's a really good one, to be honest. I feel like it's incredibly valid. valid contrast. I feel like Wolf from Manhattan are not really an expendable, you know, like one and done. Okay, yeah. Big bad of the season, like, and it's just more of a scope of like, hey, Buffy never thinks outside her little box of what monsters in town. But given that demons and all of this stuff exists, of course there are people out there exploiting that and like making it a career out of like of the, you know, the supernatural and all of that kind of thing. And it's just, I think it's a level of realism within the same universe that, you know, the tone of Buffy was never going to fit for, but like the tone of this show does fit for. And so, you know, just as a long slog as opposed to a more sort of fantastical, almost like medieval kind of, oh, a big villain that we've slayed kind of situation with Buffy.
Yeah, and I think it's important to remember that not only is Wolfram and Hart huge, and so there's many levels, many layers, many bad guys within that collective, they're also legitimate, and that's hard to take down right away. It's not like you can slay somebody and then all of a sudden the next day the building's going to be gone or something. So it makes it a more interesting villain for the series. So I do appreciate that. Let's switch gears, though, and talk about Cordy, Wes, and Gunn and they're talking about in this episode, because they get fired and they're like, okay, what do we do now? And so they go visit Lorne at the club and they want to find out their fates, except he's not going to tell them because the powers that be sort of interrupt. What do you guys think are the fates of Cordy, Wes, and Gunn? I mean, obviously, they end up taking over Angel Investigations. We kind of already talked about that. But this is an interesting sort of twist to it, because they've not necessarily broken ties with Angel, but they're kind of taking over what he used to do. And yes, Gunn and Wesley in particular would go out in the field and help, but now they don't have Angel to back them up. And that is dangerous for them, but also, I would imagine, very empowering too. And they're very determined to continue doing what they're meant to be doing, which is answering the call that Cordy hears when she gets the visions. So, like, what do you think?
I want to comment on something, but I'm looking up something to confirm what okay. I'm going to talk about. I was hoping someone else had an opinion. Oh my God, what is her name? Virginia. Okay, so I think that the whole reason why their fates, like, were, you know, not able to be read or told because of, you know, some hierarchy interference, was that they kind of know what they need to do, and they all know what they need to do, but they're just afraid to do it without Angel. And it goes exactly on what you were saying, like, Wesley and Gunn, I think, are motivated by the fact that they know that there's that extra layer behind them. Like, they're not the final stop. So if they fail or they get in trouble, there's Angel to bail them out. And now they're kind of terrified that they don't have Angel to bail them out. And so when Wesley's having this conversation with Virginia, and he's just like, she's like, oh, well, you pulled off that jacket really well. And like, that's such a telling line. Like, yeah, I pulled off the jacket. Not the actual saving the day all the time type stuff. So, you know, it's a matter of them having the confidence that they can do it. And maybe they just need to be drunk to do it, because they did a pretty good job when they were trashed. I don't even know how they were able to navigate what they were doing, because they were pretty wasted. But yeah, I think it all comes down to, you know, either the power that be seeing so far ahead that, like, you know, they know what Angel is doing. And so if they don't give them any clues as to what they should be doing, then they kind of know that they'll preoccupy themselves with, you know, oh, we're going to show Angel that we could still do it without him, which is perfect, because it does not allow them to interfere with what Angel needs to do and get done. And, you know, it allows that separation that needs to happen. But yeah, that I just really think that that the exchange with Virginia was telling for Wesley in particular. And then by the time they all showed up at the karaoke bar, for all of them to be like, okay, yeah, we do need to figure out how we're going to do it without Angel, but we also, you know, we make up a pretty good team. We got Gunn understanding what's going on. We have Wesley, who like has all his book knowledge and some manpower, and then we have Cordelia, who provides the visions, and like they're all kind of blaming each other in that scene, like, you know, like, well, if you had more visions then Angel wouldn't be so preoccupied with this, well, if you didn't do, you know, and like they are throwing their individual strengths at each other as arguments. So it was just like all the pieces are there, you just need to put on the jacket and feel like Angel and do it.
And it's amazing what you can do when you have no other options, when you don't have a plan B. And they've gotten to the point where they don't have a plan B, but they know that plan A still works even without Angel. And they're willing to fight the good fight in order to see it continue to happen. I also just wanted to point out, like, I really love Lauren. And I really think he's such an interesting character because he's not... He's so neutral, and you see him helping Angel and the others throughout the episodes, but you also see him withholding information. And in this case, he knew that Cordelia was going to have a vision, and so he wasn't going to tell them what they came there for because he knew that the powers that be were going to speak and going to tell them what they needed to do next. And it's just so interesting, the dynamic that he has with his customers and what he's willing to share and what he's willing to withhold in order to see them continue to go down the correct path.
I really love him. I'm glad we're saying his name. I'm excited for him to be around in the point that we get to say his name and therefore see him more. But this Caritas in general is a blessing to this show. Like, it is a gift of a thing to work in, like that this is a constant hub that we have to go to, that it gets the singing, that it, you know, like ridiculous, like it provides humor and it provides insight. It's like whoever thought of the idea of like, okay, as part of their ongoing universe, they're going to have this demon bar hangout that's a karaoke bar and we're going to make the use of it as much as we can. Like, God bless whoever thought that up, because it's a gift. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's actually a good transition into our favorite scenes. Brittany, do you want to take us away?
Sure. So my favorite scene was, you know, just one by one, all of the new trio showing up at the bar and just, you know, the night progressing and the montage and then them just like, you know, singing and then them like passed out on the table and like, it was so great just seeing them together and knowing that they really don't have anyone else. Like, they are going to naturally flock to a place where they seek some sort of familiarity and answers, and those answers actually come from each other and not some really awesome karaoke bar owner.
Oh, yeah, that is true. Natalie, what was your favorite scene?
Mine was just randomly, like, when Lila comes to Lindsay with the proposition, because I knew that we would be talking about Caritas and We Are the Champions and all of that. I screamed out loud laughing when they started singing and Leo had to come from the other room and check what had happened.
I love when Gunn hugs them.
Yeah. But when Lila comes to Lindsay with the proposition of, you know, them working together before they have their whole, like, battle to the death in the boardroom and him kind of not going for it and plucking the wire out of Lila's shirt and being like, no, I would never do that at work, like, you know, like, really clever, and I don't know, I really like him, guys, so sorry. Also, Angel's pastel hoodie of depression, his gray pastel hoodie of, like, you know, despair or whatever it is that he was doing with it.
And Kristen, what was your favorite scene?
I loved Darla and Drusilla. Like, when, first of all, I have never liked Drusilla, but this episode, like, she was just at a level where it all kind of worked for me. Like, I have never appreciated her crazy as much as I did this episode. But, like, when they arrive to their, like, I don't even know, that the place with the oil and all that, where they had that conversation, at the end to, like, have their little crony tryouts, and the whole scene with Angel smoking, like, you know, the real sign of a guy turning bad is that he's smoking. Like, it cracks me up. But yeah, that whole thing was just really, it was a really well done sequence, like, from the comedy of them being outside and, you know, them walking into all these guys being dead. And that whole sequence was just really cool.
And the lighting and the shot of Angel, yeah, like, it was beautiful.
Yeah.
My favorite scene was actually anytime Darla and Drusilla walked into a room, because they just instantly took charge. Like, Drusilla ripping the ears off that one demon, and just the way that they can command a room. I don't know. I really appreciate female villains, and I really like that they're very understated. I mean, Darla is not big, and Drusilla's not big either, and they look tiny and cute, and then you realize how incredibly intelligent and dangerous they are, and this is why people listen to them and follow them. And it's terrible for our good guys, but it's really cool to see it on screen nonetheless. Favorite lines? Brittany, I want to start with you, because I'm not surprised at all that you chose this one.
All right, before we do, I just wanted, because I meant to bring this up during the discussion, but I went on the wiki for this episode while I was watching it, and it contained my favorite description of Angel I've ever read in my entire life, and I just got really excited to keep watching the episode. And I tweeted a gif of Jerry from Parks and Rec along with it, but it just says, "The deadly serious Angel reinvents himself as a cold-hearted one-man weapon of mass destruction." And I was like, well, I'm sold. I don't even need to watch the episode. I know it's going to be great. How great is that description of Angel? I was so excited to keep watching the episode. I just closed out of the wiki article. I didn't even know what I was looking for anymore. But I found it.
That's great.
Yeah, but my favorite line from the episode was Darla just going, "Shut up, Drusilla." I loved it.
Not surprised at all. Natalie, what was your favorite line?
Mine was actually when they were drunk in the bar and talking to each other, the new trio, and arguing about whose fault it was. Cordy, basically about Angel, and Drusilla says, when they were like, "Oh, it's his, you know, your fault for, you know, encouraging him to make time for that or whatever," and she's like, "You have an obsession, you squeeze it into your schedule no matter what." And I just felt like that was a really poignant and true line to be saying, especially when very drunk. That's a real life lesson. Like, that's a real, not a lesson, but, like, that's a very true kind of that's a very true observation of behavior, I think, that, like,
yes,
yeah, that you always make time for what is, you know, making you crazy, whether it's in a good way or a bad way or whatever, like, in terms of prioritizing and what seems important. And I've certainly been the victim of that, perhaps in less life or death ways than Angel and Darla, and more like, I need to keep watching this television show. But yeah.
I mean, we've all been there.
Yeah.
We can just admit that now.
Yeah.
Kristen, what was your favorite line?
Mine comes from the middle of that Wesley Gunn Cordelia, like, blaming match, but that whole thing is just genius. Like, it was just fantastic. But Wesley says, "Well, how is a man supposed to run a business if his employees won't follow directives? Gunn, was one of his directives hire a pansy ass British guy?" And Wesley says, "My ass is not pansy." And then Cordy, like, throws it back at him again later and is like, yeah, "Ass pansy." It's just that stuff. It just gets me every time.
I love how they kept ganging up on each other. And, like, one minute there'd be a truce between, like, Gunn and Cordy against Wesley, like with this line, and then 2 seconds later, Wesley and Gunn would be picking on Cordy, and they'd clink beer bottles, and it was just like every man for themselves, and it was it was great. Yeah, this whole bar scene from start to finish was brilliant, but I particularly loved Gunn here. I loved that he showed up. And he was like, yeah, this is just a side gig, except no, actually, I really care about it. And he goes, I can't have you seeing through my brusque and macho exterior. And, like, it's just nice, honestly, to have him admit that, because we know he cares. He cares about people a lot, but he kind of goes about it in a way that is very, I don't want to say cruel, but it is brusque. Like, he's not a, he doesn't have great bedside manner, even if he has a really good heart and continues to try to do the right thing. He's just not necessarily an easy person to get along with. So the fact that he admitted this was really great. But then also a little bit after that, when Wesley asks him, what song were you going to sing? And Gunn just goes, you wouldn't know it, and pats him on the back. And I was like, oh, it was so great. I loved it. Okay, well, that brings us to the end of our discussion. So, as usual, if you would like to get into contact with us, please email us at rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. Find us on Twitter at re_watchable, this post on hypable.com, or rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. And as always, we really appreciate iTunes reviews. And if you rate us 5 stars, then I will revive Rat Amy.
Really?
I will. I
promise. Yes.
Yes, you better leave us those 5 stars.
Do it for Mitch, guys. Do it for Mitch.
Yes. Okay, we do have some feedback this week. These are from Twitter, so let's just run on down the list, shall we?
Sure. So the first one comes from Jen T at Basic Average Girl. It says, so sad I missed the live recording of the 200th episode. We'll definitely be there for the live 500th. Oof. that's great. Kudos to you for wanting to stick around for 300 more episodes. But if you want to...
We might be dead by then.
I know. I said I wouldn't be around, and Karen said she was offended by that, but...
I was.
Yeah, but if you want to watch it, I'll link to it in the show notes, and you can watch the whole thing. It's there. It's it lives on the internet, which is scary.
But it is terrifying.
So, Laura, I never know whether this is meant to rhyme with Laura, like if it's Moro or Mauro, I'm not sure how that last name is pronounced, but Laura Mauro 123, your live episode was so lovely, lovely to put faces to voices I've heard for years. Keep up the good work. There's a couple of smiley faces in there. That's nice. Yes, so that's the first live stream I've done with Rewatchable, I think. We've done a couple for Not Another Teen Wolf podcast before, but yeah, I don't know. Live streams are weird. I feel like it's very strange. We had the whole thing at the beginning where I couldn't get the table in the right spot, and like, I don't know, I feel very anxious being on the camera, so I don't
Something
know if everyone else had fun.
Something always goes wrong, and it's always awkward, and you can't edit, and you have to not be careful what you say, because we pretty much say what's on our mind, but like, the fact that it's live makes it a little different. But also, Natalie, I don't know if you noticed, but something kind of went wrong because your face is the face of the whole podcast episode. Like, it never
for the
switched
whole thing?
Yeah, it never switched between us.
On YouTube?
Yeah.
That's really bad.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I know why it is. Technically, it's because I was hosting. It was because mine was the one getting...
But it still should have switched.
I know. I don't know why it did that, but it's because I was logged into the camera from the Rewatchable account, which was hosting, was on me. But it still should have switched and had the person pop up when they talked.
Oh, so that means that Gage is always so tiny.
Yeah.
That's really, I can't, now everyone's going to think that I'm gross and bossy.
No,
like,
no.
Oh, why didn't anyone say anything at the time?
I didn't realize it until later. So, but that's okay. You have a lovely
Google
face.
Every time we do a Google Hangout, something has changed with the process every single time, because it's only once every year or so, and there's always something weird that happens. And, oh, that's so embarrassing. Okay. Anyway.
Sorry. Moving on. Caitlin McCaw says, on board with Charmed, but there needs to be a couple shorter shows first. Yes, two political animals. We will be doing shorter shows before we do anything that's longer, Charmed or not. I don't know if I can convince enough people to do Charmed, but shorter shows first. We're going to do probably a couple lightning rounds after this one just to kind of liven us up again, because we're probably all going to be dead.
There was another one I thought of the other day that I was like, oh, I should have said that, which was House. And another one that I wanted to watch from the beginning, which was Prison Break, because I love Wentworth Miller as a human being, as we've spoken about earlier in the Buffy podcast. I think he's one of the most amazing writers and amazing, like, people for speaking their minds, but I've not really seen his, like, body of work that much. I've seen the movie he wrote, but I haven't seen, like, Prison Break, so I'd kind of like to do that.
Kristen and I watched the first one or two episodes of Prison Break, and it was interesting from the get-go.
Yeah, we watched it right before the big move, so we kind of lost track of where we started it, but it was interesting for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And last but never least, for the tweets, Maria Lovegood says, love rewatchable so much that I audibly gasped with excitement hearing that Gage is now going outside. Hashtag animal lover, hashtag super fan of rewatchable. Yeah, I think we all love the ongoing saga that is Gage and adventure.
Super fan of rewatchable. That's terrifying and lovely at the same time.
It's cute.
Thank you so much. And we do have a Hyperbole comment from Melissa, and Mitch has told Natalie she has to read this one.
I guess. I feel like because he knows that I feel the opposite, but which is mean. I don't know. Was anyone on Into the Woods? Were any of you guys on that episode?
Negative.
So it was literally the complete opposite. It was Caitlin, Ariana, Mitch, and Mai on Into the Woods.
Yes.
Must have been, yeah.
Okay, well, that's fine. So that was actually an interesting place for us to break and have our live stream and not go straight back in, because that was a mid-season finale. So Into the Woods was a finale, and then this was a mid-season premiere. But Melissa on Hyperbole has said, I was surprised by some of the host's reaction to Xander's speech to Buffy in Into the Woods. It's one of the more memorable moments of the show for me. I always felt that Xander really steps up here and we realize how mature he's becoming and how observant he is when it comes to Buffy. I never saw it as him giving her flack for being a strong, independent woman. There's a line between strong and independent and being just plain uninterested in someone. She may be dealing with a lot right now, but you know that if she were with Angel through all of this, she would have told him the truth about Dawn, she would have immediately gone to him about her mom, etc. Riley certainly has his flaws that are affecting their relationship, but Buffy is shutting him out. She really doesn't love him, and she's not coming to terms with it. I, for one, am really glad Xander had the guts to say it to her, because somebody needed to. Okay, that's fair, but the vampire sucking thing is the clincher for me. Like, in terms of, yes, I feel like that, you know, if she was, you know, stringing Riley along and, you know, we have that moment of Dawn being like, she never gets that worked up over you. I think you're really good for her. And then Riley's just like, oh, kill me now. But I think that all of that's valid and all of that should have equaled in Buffy coming to terms and saying, oh, yeah, I should let him go. I'm actually not really in this, as opposed to being like, oh, my God, I need to treat him better, whatever. The point is, Xander is saying, is basically, I can't remember in that scene whether Xander knows about what has happened to Riley, whether Xander knows for a fact that Riley has done those things, or whether he's just saying.
I don't think so.
If he doesn't, it's kind of okay. If he does know and he's still being like, oh, so what? He did that, but you've been a terrible girlfriend, you know, like, then I'm just like, no. So I don't know. I really felt like it wasn't Xander's place to say anything, but I do feel like that Buffy was using Riley and shutting him out, and that she was happy with their relationship being a bit less intense and casual. And the fact that she then apparently realizes that she doesn't feel that way and turns around and wants to run to him is like, oh, he's the guy that comes along once in a lifetime. Like, I just didn't feel it realistic that she would actually feel that way. Like, that she would actually have that change of heart. Like, how is she that stupid? Like, sorry, but like,
is she that stupid that she didn't realize she felt that strongly about him and that she didn't realize how she was treating him was that bad? I felt that she was perfectly aware of it and that she was happy with it being that step down. And that, you know, yes, it wasn't fair on Riley because he felt more intensely, but that, you know, she should realize that and then let him go as opposed to the other way around. I don't know. If none of you guys were on Into the Woods, like, how did you feel about that Xander Buffy run situation?
I watched this episode very late yesterday, like getting ready for today because I was a little behind. And so maybe I wasn't like paying as much attention, but I didn't really feel like Xander was even like being Riley's cheerleader per se. Like, I felt like he was just like, Buffy, hello. You know, you never would have acted like this with someone else. Like, it's not Riley, it's you. Like, you are different with him than you've been before. You have to be okay with what's going on. Like, I felt like he was just more of a reality check for her. Like, you know, like, have you been paying attention? Have you seen what you've been doing? This is the reality of what's going on. Not Riley is a great guy and you should be with Riley and how dare you treat him badly. Like, it was more just like, Buffy, are you aware of what's been going on? Like, I don't think you are. And I'm going to try and help you see the light. Like, I thought that was more of what was going on than him, like, trying to talk Riley up and trying to convince her that she should be with him. And, that, you know, so when she ran off to get Riley, I thought it was more of a, I still want something with him. Like, I, you know, I haven't seen it. I wasn't aware of how badly I was treating him. I've been so preoccupied with 3,000 other things that I was not being the girlfriend, and I want to make it right. Like, I want us to make this right. We want to work at making this better. Like, that's what I saw come out of it, not the other way around.
Yeah, I don't think Xander was unnecessarily butting his way into their relationship. I think he was responding to the fact that he wants Buffy to be happy and sort of presenting a reality like, well, this is the reality and he is a nice guy and he's a great guy and all, you know, like, really was talking Riley up, but at the same time, like, you know, I think he was doing it in a way to be like, you're not seeing this, and that's okay, but you have to know that this is what's going on and what everyone else is seeing. And if you're not happy with it, then fine, walk away. That's totally cool.
Yeah, I think saying that it's a reality check is probably the most accurate way to depict that. So very good discussion. Glad we got to also kind of weigh in on that. So next week's episodes, we're going to jump into Brittany's brainstorms and Kristen's contemplations. We've got Buffy 512 Checkpoint and Angel 212 Blood Money. Have at it.
Well, I want to talk about Angel first because I really don't know where we could go with Angel. Like, are we going to have two conflicting storylines with hopefully one with no voiceover? And, like, are we going to have these parallel stories? So are, like, Cordelia and Wesley and Gunn, are they going to be, you know, doing their thing and solving, you know, or helping some people? Or, and then we're going to have Angel, like, doing his thing. Or are we going to jump right back into, you know, them kind of trying to butt heads or coming together in some way? So, Kristen, what do you think? Because I really don't know.
I don't know how long it's going to take for Cordy and Wesley and Gunn. They're clearly going to be doing something on their own. They're going to be running Angel investigations and they're going to be trying to help people. I'm trying to figure out how long it's going to take for them to accidentally step in on an Angel mission. Like, I don't know if it's going to be this upcoming episode. Like, it could be. He goes out to stop Drew and Drusilla and, you know, Cordy gets a vision and it throws them in the same place right away. Like, it could happen. I know it's going to happen. Like, it has to. But, like, I'm trying to decide if 212 is a little early for that or if we're going to get, like, parallel separate storylines. Somehow they have to interact because you know, it's Angel and his team. Like, even if it's just a momentary passing each other on the street or something, like, we have to see them. And as far as, like, what blood money could actually mean, I have no idea. But he's a vampire, so
yeah.
Maybe he's selling his blood or something. Who knows?
Yeah, and then Buffy, maybe Checkpoint is sort of like for Dawn, because I think we kind of left it where Dawn doesn't know where she stands, and so the checkpoint could be a reference to, okay, like, you know, everybody needs to get all their cards on the table and fill Dawn in as much as you think is appropriate, like a let her, like a pass a checkpoint, like, okay, Dawn, yes, something is going on, but it's nothing you need to worry about, so it's fine. Like, you know, maybe just seeing where everyone is with the information.
Yeah, or like, I, for some reason, when I saw a checkpoint, like, it made me think of video games and like a save point.
Yeah.
So like something big is going to happen that's going to be like, I don't know if it's going to be like the point where everything changes. This moment is the point where everything was still okay, and now that Dawn knows what's going, you know, has an idea of that she is something else, and, you know, with everything else going on, like, from here on out, it's going to be different, and everything's going to go crazy. Like, that was my first initial thing, was, like, a save point in a video game. That's has something to do with this episode. That's all I got.
Hey, those are great guesses, and we'll just have to wait until next week to find out. But until then, thank you everybody for listening once again. And my name is Karen.
I'm Natalie.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Brittany.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.